At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 million in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Do you, Yahoo? Because Microsoft doesn't, at least not anymore. For shareholders, perhaps the question is, do you, Boohoo? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Cinco de Mayo. It is Monday, the 5th day of May. 4 months of computer dating came to an end over the weekend. Microsoft finally gave up on wooing search engine Yahoo into a long-term relationship. The planet's biggest software maker was willing to offer $33 a share for a company that was worth just over $19 a share before the merger bid. Today, shareholders punished Yahoo with a 15% price drop. Ina Fried is here to explain. She's with CNetNews.com. What happened?
Well, you know, these two sides have been pretty far apart for a while now. There was a glimmer of hope. Late last week, the two sides wanted to talk some more. They did. And it turned out they just couldn't get any closer.
You know, this really all seems to have come down to price. And there are a lot of questions today about Jerry Yang, CEO of Yahoo, and how he can back up a demand for $37 a share.
It's pretty tough, especially when shareholders themselves, you know, some of the larger ones were saying, we would have taken 34 at 35.
Yeah.
It's a tough road that Yahoo staked out for themselves.
Is this over at this point?
It is for now. I mean, I think the one thing Yahoo was successful at was convincing Microsoft that if it went hostile, it would not be a pretty picture. I think the question is, do Yahoo's shareholders put significant pressure enough on Yahoo to push them back to the table?
All right, let's do a quick review for both sides here. Why did Microsoft even need to go after Yahoo?
There were two things that Microsoft was looking for. One, the engineering talent, but there are a few different ways they could have gotten that. The other is scale. They're looking to take on Google for the long term. They see this as a years-long battle, and they want to bulk up as much as they can. And Yahoo was the big other player that they could acquire. And there really aren't a lot of other options to give themselves the kind of scale that Yahoo would have brought.
What are the options at this point? I mean, they've been talking about AOL for a while. There's MySpace and Facebook out there.
Well, those are the big three that naturally come to mind. You know, with MySpace and Facebook, those are obviously huge audiences. It's been a lot tougher for companies to monetize the kind of audience that you get with social networking compared to what you get in search or even general web.
All right. What about Yahoo? What happens next for them?
Well, this is going to be some real defining time for them. I mean, the first step is they've got to convince shareholders that they have a plan. I think some of that's going to come from, I mean, they've said they're going to probably move ahead with this deal with Google, where some of their search advertising they outsource to Google. That could boost revenue in the short term, but strategically could be a challenge for them. I mean, they're giving away another piece that potentially could differentiate them. AOL tried a similar route, and it has been financially okay, but, you know, has helped them kind of further become less relevant.
Well, let me ask you one more question about Jerry Yang. What was really going on here, do you think? Did he just simply not want to sell Yahoo?
I talked with a source close to the negotiations, and that's exactly what they said. Their sense was that Jerry just didn't want to sell. And, I mean, don't forget, Yahoo was not on the block. It was not shopping itself. Microsoft has been knocking for a couple of years now. So I think his negotiating stance reflected, if we're going to get bought, it's going to be on our terms.
And it does sound like, even though this feels like the end, it might not be. Microsoft could come back to Yahoo again.
They could. I mean, there aren't that many options. So I think the idea that this settles Yahoo's future as independent once and for all is a bit of a stretch.
Ina Fried is a senior writer with CNETnews.com. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Tess.
Shares in Yahoo lost almost half the gains they'd seen since Microsoft's first offer in January. That plus a new high in oil prices made for a rocky start to the week on Wall Street. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Ever want to say in the boss's pay? Well, today investors in the insurance company Aflac became the first shareholders of a major U.S. company to vote on the salaries of top executives. Corporations have generally frowned on the idea, but after today's vote, seems like they don't have much to worry about. Aflac's shareholders overwhelmingly rubber-stamped a pay package put together by the board of directors. John Dimsdale reports.
Aflac is one of only a small handful of companies to voluntarily submit their compensation packages to a shareholder vote. CEO Dan Amos says he was nervous before investors rendered their verdict.
I felt like with the return we'd given the shareholders it would pass, but I wanted it to do better than pass. And because we were the first company to do it, I really had no idea what the results would be.
In the end, 93% of the shareholders endorsed the board's pay proposal for the company's top five executives, including a $12 million package for Amos, who's headed the company for nearly 19 years.
Since I've been CEO, our stock has gone from $1.80 a share to $67. I would hope that would be in large part the reason, and also the way that we actually pay for performance. If they do well, then I do well as a CEO.
Not all boards of directors see it that way. Few have been willing to allow input from shareholders. But Florida State Management Professor Wayne Huckwarder says today's vote could change things.
Shareholders who are yet to be shareholders may look at that and say, you know, I kind of like the fact that I might be able to get involved in decision making. I might be able to have some input. I may feel like I'm part of the team other than simply just the financial support.
Huckwarder says company boards willing to give up some management control can also share the risk of making bad management decisions with shareholders. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Chinese President Hu Jintao has got a lot on his mind these days. Criticism over Tibet, the Olympics, inflation. So he's taking a break and heading to Japan. He leaves tomorrow for a five-day visit aimed at healing tensions between Asia's two biggest rivals. China and Japan have a complicated relationship. They're economic competitors and collaborators. During the visit, they're expected to unveil a plan for managing their economic interests in the coming years. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Japan, China, and you are more connected than you may think. Take your iPod. Japan's Toshiba makes the hard drive, and Chinese workers snap the parts together before they're sold. This Asian partnering helps Japan remain the world's number two economy. And China is hot on Germany's tail for third. But a big source of tension is China's pollution now blowing over Japan. David Zweig is with the Hong Kong University for Science and Technology.
Industrial growth in China has devastated lakes and forests in northern Japan in particular. This is a lot like the U.S. and Canada, where manufacturing in the Ohio Valley has killed 50,000 lakes in Ontario and Quebec.
This week, he expects Japan to push China on emissions caps and offer ideas on how to achieve them. There's less give and take on traditional energy, namely undersea natural gas reserves that both sides claim. And there's friction over Chinese food exports after a case of pesticide-tainted dumplings. Still, neither side can afford a trade spat, since Japan's top export market is China. Lots of bulldozers and cranes, says economist Glenn McGuire of Societe Generale.
It is Japanese heavy machinery. It's Japanese steel. The old sectors of the Japanese economy are enjoying a great deal of support from China at the moment.
He thinks a softer world economy will pinch Japan and China. But since they rely so much on each other, the pain from North America's credit crunch may wear off quickly. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Contemporary art from China is all the rage these days. Sotheby's sold more than $227 million worth of Chinese art and jewelry during a recent sales event in Hong Kong. Meanwhile, the New York auction season opens today. Sotheby's and Christie's are hoping to sell $1.8 billion worth of Impressionist and modern art. That's 25% more than last year. Jill Barshay paints a picture for us of an art bubble that's just getting bigger and bigger despite Wall Street layoffs and a struggling U.S. economy.
The auction houses are so confident of the art market that they're guaranteeing half the sales. That means they'll buy the art at a minimum price if no one else does. Amy Capolazzo is the deputy chairman of Christie's. She says prices are so high that veteran collectors are unloading famous paintings by Monet, Rothko, and an Andy Warhol print of Marlon Brando perched on a motorcycle.
It's an estimate on request, and since you're requesting, it's in the region of $30 million.
Capolazzo says new foreign investors from China, Russia, and the Middle East are fueling the New York art auctions, and ultra-rich Americans are still buying.
The art market might be more akin to very, very high-end real estate in Manhattan, whereby you're seeing anything that's sort of rare, precious, special, one-of-a-kind, unique, is actually kind of holding up.
But cracks are showing. Joan Whalen is a veteran New York art dealer and consultant. She says the Wall Street crowd stopped buying art after their year-end bonuses dwindled or vanished.
The middle market has suffered a great deal. If you have a painting for $500,000 or $1 million, it'll be gone tomorrow. If you have a painting $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, you're going to have trouble selling it.
That explains Christie's and Sotheby's new policy. They no longer accept consignments for less than $50,000. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
For those of you who've been living on Mars, voters in Indiana and North Carolina are going to the polls tomorrow to help determine the Democratic presidential nominee. One thing the candidates aren't talking about at all? Mars. Space policy in general. So as they campaign in the state that houses the university, Purdue, that has graduated 22 astronauts, Jeremy Hobson takes a look at the candidates' plans for the final frontier.
Plans may be a strong word. Maybe we should go with initial thoughts.
I want to use some of that money to train engineers and scientists who are going to be able to take us to those next new frontiers.
That's Barack Obama talking about diverting some of NASA's $17 billion budget into education. And that comment has caused quite a stir among the space crowd. Obama's campaign couldn't provide an official space advisor to elaborate because they don't seem to have one. Same with John McCain, who's hinted at a continuation of the Bush space policy, which has been criticized as underfunded. Hillary Clinton does have an advisor. Her name is Lori Garver.
I think as president, she would encourage more international cooperation, more commercial development, and if it requires more money, she would support that.
More money is music to the ears of the folks at NASA, though even Clinton's plans have been criticized as lacking specificity. But there are a lot of others listening, too, and there's a lot more to space policy than NASA.
There'll be dozens of smaller decisions having to do with space technologies and how they affect our day-to-day life. And a president will have to make those.
Richard Dalbello is with the satellite industry giant Intelsat. He says the next president will have to think about auctioning off valuable communication spectrum, regulating the emerging space tourism industry, and dealing with the possibility of the weaponization of space and whether that will become an industry of its own. Teresa Hitchens at the Center for Defense Information has some big questions on that front, especially since the Chinese shot down one of their own satellites last year.
How we ensure that our satellites are protected, do we need to have an offensive space strategy that sees the United States building anti-satellite weapons and other sorts of weapons based in space, perhaps.
If building anti-satellite weapons were to become big business, you can bet Lockheed Martin would be involved. But John Karas, who heads the Human Spaceflight Division there, sees an even bigger threat to the economy if the next president doesn't make space a priority.
We won't be able to sustain the workforce we have, let alone compete in the global marketplace.
Karas says there's statistical evidence to prove the space program inspires thousands of Americans to go into science and technology.
If China is graduating 5 to 7 to 8 times more graduates, and we have no pull into that science community, you know, for the next generation of scientists and engineers, I think we'll suffer.
So if intellect is the future of the American economy, we've got to find ourselves some geniuses.
Exactly right. And you have to grow those at home.
So what's the total impact of space policy on the economy? Well, Marty Hauser with the Nonpartisan Space Foundation has the view from 30,000 feet, or perhaps low Earth orbit. His latest report says the space industry is worth more than $250 billion a year, and that's not even the half of it.
As a common citizen, we're connected to it. We look at the weather on the evening news. Farmers want it for their crops. People use it for navigation. The taxi driver who drove me here today has a TomTom on his dash that he uses to help navigate through the city.
That's all well and good, but in a campaign that many complain has spent too much time on side issues and gaffes, space policy now has bigger down-to-earth competition for the candidates' attention. High food prices, oil prices, and foreclosure rates. It seems those with billions staked on the next president's space policy will just have to wait and hope. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, a dismal housing market means golden opportunity for some.
I'm not really trying to take advantage of these bad conditions, but at the same time, these bad conditions just happen to coincide with my need for more rental property.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street's credit worries returned today, pushing the Dow down 0.2%, 88 points to close at 12,969. The Nasdaq fell 0.5%, 12 points to close at 2,464. The S&P 500 gave back almost 0.5%, 6 points to end the day at 1,407. Crude oil gushed over $120 a barrel for a new record high. Unrest in Nigeria and comments from Iran fueled supply concerns. We already mentioned Microsoft and Yahoo. Countrywide Financial forfeited more than 10% after analysts suggested that Bank of America should walk away from its pending deal for the mortgage lender. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note climbed to 3.87. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the House Education and Labor Committee discusses whether employers recruit U.S. workers before foreign guest workers are hired. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee holds a hearing on contaminants in the drinking water. And no matter how you feel about it, Austrian physician Sigmund Freud was born on May 6, 1856. Your unconscious mind may know him as the father of psychoanalysis. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Tomorrow in Washington, the Federal Trade Commission will take a look at our growing dependency on mobile phones and the growing number of ways advertisers are pushing their messages there. Of course, the ads usually come as an add-on to something else, like news. Today, the Associated Press and 100 of its member newspapers launched a service that'll allow you better access to local news on the go. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains.
It's called the Mobile News Network. The idea is to bring the newspaper to you so you don't need the newspaper. The free service is specially formatted for the iPhone and other mobile devices, considered the new promised land in the digital landscape.
This is a very interesting move.
That's veteran journalist Adam Clayton Powell III. He says the struggling newspaper industry realizes it has to get as much exposure for its content in as many places as possible or lose more ground.
It's better for the AP and for newspapers to have a piece of this new and growing platform, iPhone, than to ignore it and let Yahoo and Google and Microsoft snap it up.
Online news pioneer Merrill Brown says this alliance is an easy way for newspapers to get up and running in the hot medium of mobile.
I think it's an interim step before the individual companies figure out their own strategies.
For now, there's strength in numbers as print tries to move toward the future.
If you're struggling with lots of technological challenges on even the basic web, then using your AP relationship to get at least up and running on the iPhone is an easy transitional step.
The AP and its member newspapers are hoping to generate a big enough audience for their new service to attract advertising dollars, which will be split among the partners. This mobile news network is one more reason you never have to get ink smudges on your hands. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
It's one of those small pleasures in life, not paying sales tax on some of the stuff you buy online. It usually happens if the site doesn't have any actual stores in the state you live in. But now, New York is an exception. Online retailers must charge sales tax if they have affiliate marketing agreements with businesses in the state. Amazon is suing over the law, but commentator Michael Mazaroff says internet retailers should play by the same rules as the shop on the corner.
One of the great things about shopping online is that you don't have to pay sales tax, right? Wrong. If your state taxes a shirt when you buy it in a store, then you're actually required to pay the same amount of tax directly to your state when you buy it on the internet. Of course, most people don't do that. And many internet retailers don't charge the tax because the Supreme Court has said they don't have to. There are good reasons to change this and require all internet merchants to charge sales taxes. It has to do with fairness. If your local bookstore has to charge sales tax when Amazon doesn't, that puts the store at a competitive disadvantage, and this puts local jobs at risk. Of course, you can avoid sales tax on internet purchases only if you can afford a computer that links you to online retailers. The less well-off already pay a larger share of their income in sales taxes than those who are better off. And a two-tiered system that allows wealthier wired consumers to dodge sales taxes while poorer people continue to pay sales taxes in local stores, makes this imbalance worse. Finally, states lose billions of dollars every year in sales taxes because of internet shopping. As online retail grows, the lost revenue increases. This makes it harder for states and towns to hire police, fix the roads, and improve the schools. States have been pushing for a federal law to let them require all large internet sellers to charge sales tax. Congress hasn't agreed to it, because nobody wants to be accused of voting for a new tax. Some members also thought internet commerce needed time to get on its feet without taxes. But the internet isn't a toddler anymore, and these aren't new taxes. By requiring internet businesses to collect the sales tax, we'd just be making them play by the same rules as the mom-and-pop store on Main Street. That only seems fair.
Michael Mazaroff is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, issued a new warning to mortgage lenders today. Get busy refinancing risky mortgages or face new and much tougher regulation. Many homeowners are frantic to refinance as their home values drop. But on the other side of the equation are buyers who refuse to jump in until the market hits bottom. How will they know when it does? Investors known as bottom fishermen just might have the answer. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio explains.
Brian Bass stands outside a four-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath house on a corner lot in Cary, North Carolina. He likes the big yard out back and the location, but he has one problem with the property before he ever steps inside.
This looks pretty good, but I think it's overpriced.
Bass is what real estate professionals call a bottom fisherman. He's a small-time investor who is looking to add to his stable of about a half dozen houses, which he's turned into rental properties. The spike in foreclosures, while tragic for others, is a boon for him.
It's kind of like this perfect storm of low interest rates and an increase in foreclosures. I'm not really trying to take advantage of these bad conditions, but at the same time, these bad conditions just happen to coincide with my need for more rental property.
Bottom fishermen like Bass are more than just opportunistic investors. They're an important indicator in the real estate market, says Carl Case. He's a professor of economics at Wellesley College. He's also the co-creator of the Case-Shiller Index, a key measure of the residential housing market.
When you start to see bottom fishermen, when you start to see people buying up property on spec, it's the first sign that opinion is changing. They're the first to form the view that, hey, there's going to be some bargains.
Experts say the number of bottom fishermen looking for those bargains is rising. Jeremy Brandt owns a company called 1-800-CASH-OFFER. It connects investors with those who want to sell a house fast. Sellers who are in trouble have been calling in record numbers, and in the coming months, Brandt expects the number of potential buyers to grow.
There are definitely a lot of people that are saying, I've heard all this bad news about real estate, so it must be a great time to buy.
Brandt says one of the real dangers is buying a property without knowing the local market.
We've had thousands, if not tens of thousands, of novice investors buying on speculation without any real understanding of the fundamentals and the market they were buying into. We've seen a lot of investors that were buying property sight unseen or in an area that was outside of their city.
That kind of speculation combined with the mortgage mess is what got us into the housing slump in the first place. Which brings us back to that question, are we at the bottom? Carl Case says probably, but he's quick to point out that this decline is unlike any other. The national scope of the slump hasn't been seen since the Great Depression. And the credit crunch means even willing buyers with good credit are finding it hard to get mortgages. Brian Bass has refinanced his own home twice to pay for the rental properties he's buying, but he says he's being careful not to get overextended.
I know how much I'm making, and I'm realistic about that, and so I just try not to spend more than I make.
The future of the housing market may depend on how many other bottom fishermen follow his advice. In Cary, North Carolina, I'm Dave DeWitt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist, committed to writing about issues that matter and the connections between them. The Economist, see the world differently. At newsstands and economist.com. And by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, there may be no love lost between Microsoft and Yahoo, but another internet company is feeling the love from a higher power. PaidContent.org reports that hedge fund investors have answered the prayers of an online video sharing site called GodTube. GLG Partners ponied up $30 million in funding for the Christian website, which boasts some 2 million users a month. No small miracle when you don't have talking cats or exploding Coke bottles. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 88 points, 0.67%. The Nasdaq lost 12 points, 0.5%. And the S&P fell 6 points, also 0.5%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, slowing down speed cameras in France.
They smashed the lens, poured gasoline inside, and set it on fire. My opinion is that speed cameras can be useful, but not always, when they're put in places where there's no particular accident danger.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.